Welcome to the Command Line Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. I was commiserating with a friend of mine from my former think tank days about the repeal of the FCC's privacy rules. She made an interesting point to me about how this was preparation for the upcoming fight over net neutrality. It's sad that we lose ground on any of these sorts of issues, but it is important to understand that we need to preserve the will and the energy to keep engaging with these issues if we believe in things like online privacy and a fair and open internet. If you want to talk about these issues, and I think this upcoming discussion I'm going to share with you, me just trying to unpack a little bit about that privacy fight and the net neutrality fight that's just starting up in earnest, you can join in an ongoing conversation on the IRC channel for the show. It's on Freenode, and the channel name is #CMDLN. That's CMDLN. I know I didn't give the best instructions for finding the channel, although it's reasonably easy to find, I think, if you do a topic search. And some new folks showed up. I was very gratified for that. In particular, NLIADM, Naya Latham, not sure if that's meant to be pronounced or it's short for something, joined after the first new episode in a while here and started a good discussion around this notion of some sort of conservation law for power, something that they said they just kind of discussed with their friends and felt that there was something there. I agree in as far as thinking about the movement of power in the frame of what I talked about in terms of that piece on digital citizenship is instructive and important to understand how technologies shift and inform our choices as both users of technologies and creators of technologies. I did push back a little bit, and they conceded the point here, that technology, I think, actually can create something new. It can create new powers through new capabilities and opportunities that may not have existed before. It bears some thought, though, in terms of when that's genuinely the case versus when it's concentrating or reconcentrating or rediffusing power that's already in place. Naya Latham made a good point about Gmail. That was the prime example, I think, that drove a lot of the discussions around this idea of conservation, that email is really SMTP, the underlying protocol, still a very good example of a federated system at scale. Being distributed then is an architectural way of keeping power from getting too concentrated, as it were. However, Gmail shows that through the efforts of some Google engineers with their discretionary 20% time and a market and some norms that are really interested in a much more usable interface layer on top of this older technology can shift that it's not enough to look at the technological sort of setup, as it were. You really do have to use frameworks like the one that I espouse from Larry Lessig's book, Code, that encourages us to think more broadly and more across these sorts of intersecting factors and tensions. Anyway, if that's the kind of conversation you're interested in, do come and find us on the IRC channel. Jump in. We can continue the conversations about digital citizenship. We can talk about the fights at the FCC, which I'm about to share some thoughts on here in a couple of minutes. And as always, of course, you can reach out through all of the other feedback mechanisms, email. You can find me on Keybase. Another thing that I realized since I mentioned that last time is I think they may still be in an invite-only mode. If you need invitations, if you would like to check out Keybase for yourself, let me know. Send a note to feedback@thecommandline.net, and I'm happy to share any of the handful of invitations that I have for that service. The The coverage and discussion around the repeal of the FCC privacy rules seems like it's died down, and yet I think it's worth continuing to talk about this, mostly because of the way I think that it frames the opportunity to push back against the now spinning up fight against repealing the network neutrality rules at the FCC. Both of these issues are fairly complex. I want to back up a bit and try to clarify if I can, especially the FCC privacy rules. Hopefully that will set the stage a bit as well for what has already started to take shape and what the opportunities for resistance will be in the fight to preserve network neutrality. It's important to understand that the FCC privacy rules were not in effect. They were set to go into effect later this year. I linked to some coverage in my social network sharing by John Brodkin at Ars Technica, and I can drop some links into the show notes here, that provides excellent background on this. This all actually stems from one of, I think, the better things that FCC Tom Wheeler, former chairperson Tom Wheeler, did while he was at that agency. He did better than his predecessor in terms of trying to bring some more regulatory oversight to the internet service providers in particular. He did this by reclassing them under Title II. This is a decades-old telecommunications law. Under Title II, they are common carriers. That gives the SEC arguably more purview to set rules of the road, like network neutrality, like strong expectations of privacy, in exchange for some consideration at being more utility-like. The ISPs and carriers understandably don't like this. They basically want to operate with as little accountability as possible, to just do what it is that they want to do, especially for them to compete against who they call the edge providers. These are the companies that don't provide carriage per se, but content. Think Google, Facebook, Twitter, Netflix, etc. One of the downsides of that reclassification from about a year and a half ago is that it removed the ISPs from the privacy oversight exercised by the Federal Trade Commission. That's why we needed these rules that were going to go into effect later this year to restore rules of the road in the area of consumer privacy. The ISPs, understandably, want the FTC because it's the same body that expresses those expectations against those so-called edge providers. In practice, the FTC has very little regulatory authority here. Their rules traditionally have been more sort of recommendations. If industry would like to abide by these, they may, but there isn't any sort of strong force to keep them honest to do what is in the best interest of consumer privacy. As weak as the FTC rules were, they were at least something. Now we're in a position where we have nothing despite this avowed interest in moving ISPs back under the FTC's auspices. It's kind of hard to see, from my perspective, how this makes sense. It is not like, in and of themselves, the ISPs are directly comparable to the content providers that they whinge on about unfair treatment in comparison to. Sure, they are increasingly dipping their toes into that market, spinning up things like Go90, other video services to directly compete in that space, to provide their own over-the-top. That actually has a very fraught regulatory history too. These were under Janikowski's rules, the so-called special services, where originally his original formulation of net neutrality was the net could be neutral for open over-the-top services, but if an ISP had something that really just ran within their network, then they could classify it as a so-called specialized service, and then they didn't have to abide by the same rules as, say, an outside competitor like Netflix. Really, the ISPs want it whichever way gives them the most advantage. If they can be treated as if they are an edge provider, and that gives them, say, a less of a regulatory burden to step up to, so be it. If in some circumstance it swings the other way and being treated as a form of carrier, common or otherwise, makes it less costly to run their business, increases their margins, you can bet dollars to donuts that they're going to side and push for that interpretation of things. That's what really rankles here, is that they may put forward a rhetoric about different classes of actors, what fairness is, how they want to be compared to others in terms of just having some reasonable expectations. But I really think that the subtext here is other than that. I think it is that rather than them being content with just carrying bits, this was an argument that was made years ago, I want to say by David Weiner or David Farber, about delaminating the ISPs to just be dumb pipes. They don't want that. And I think the reason they don't want that is because, as I said, they have this much more sort of protean stance where they can act like whatever it is to their advantage to be regulated as and get away with this kind of slipperiness that's so frustrating. Before I dig into the just spinning up fight about net neutrality, I do want to chat a bit about an aspect of the privacy rules fight that was discussed in the various coverage, and that is namely what we could do as a consumer. Now, again, it's not like we were put into immediately a privacy rules no man's land. We've already were in that situation. What's so concerning about the CRA amendment that was used to repeal the FCC privacy rules is in this interregnum, until the ISPs are moved back to the Federal Trade Commission or some other legislated authority is brought into play to enact privacy rules, that particular amendment means that the FCC not only can't go forward with the rules that they were planning to enforce, but they can't make similar rules like them in the future. That's what's so distressing to me. And really, there aren't many options in terms of how to protect yourself from things like DNS hijacking, the so-called unkillable super cookies, any number of things that we've had hints over the years about how ISPs might take advantage of this lack of oversight. Some folks have been espousing virtual private networks as a solution, and sure, on a certain level that could cloak your traffic from your ISP if you had concerns about them collecting data on you and selling that onwards. However, it really just shifts the burden. Now you have to ask the question of whether you trust the virtual private network operator. There are some good lists of rankings of VPNs out there. I'll try to link to one in the show notes, but they're long, and the criteria used to rank them sometimes can be a bit complicated. Even then, if the ISP and the VPN are managed in this way, you still have to transit through another ISP on the other end that may or may not be in the US under this lack of privacy rules, or might be in another jurisdiction that's even worse. And if you're lucky, you can kind of figure out where the VPN transits, where your exit traffic is, and maybe have some sense of how that can protect you. There are also the technical complexities of using a VPN. There are some better clients for Mac and Windows out there, but there are some very in the weeds sorts of things that you want to get right with these VPNs. And the clients that make them the most simple really are for desktops and laptops. If you want to protect your phone, if you actually want to put it on your wireless router to protect your network, that's a non-trivial task. That might be a non-starter for some people in terms of utilizing them to have strong assurances of privacy. Well, Tor. Surely Tor must be a better solution. And sadly, I think that Tor is, in the Onion router, is in many ways comparable to VPNs in terms of the complexity. It may, in some instances, be even more complicated to get set up. Both VPNs and the Onion router mean that you're going to take a certain performance hit. There's an overhead in encrypting your traffic and tunneling it in the ways that these technologies do. And with Tor, sadly, if you log into something, a lot of the privacy protections are eroded by that. That fact that there is some point of correlation, even in an otherwise anonymized network, that could potentially be backtracked to your session. As limited as VPNs and Tor are, they're probably the best options if you're looking for a technical solution, just understanding that they're not going to be perfect and that they may require trade-offs that are deal breakers for some people. There's another idea that I've seen in coverage that I just wanted to talk about just briefly, because mostly I think that this is a technique that hasn't really been proven to be anywhere as useful as these other technologies that I talked about. And that's this notion of jamming. This comes up in anti-censorship and in circumvention technology quite a bit. The idea is that while you're browsing, in some way or another, you're spinning up many other sessions doing false things to make it harder, supposedly, for an attacker to tease out which is the real session, who is the real user, and in this case, to glean something from them that makes them valuable in terms of selling their private data on their online habits to advertisers for targeted advertising and the like. The issue is that, as far as I can tell, there hasn't been any approach to this that basically hasn't been foiled. The cover traffic is just not convincing enough to truly mask the real signal in all of that noise. Worse, there may be costs here that are unbearable in terms of, for folks who only have a mobile connection, this is going to impact their usage quite a bit and may make it infeasible just in terms of the cost to do this approach. So if they naively think they may get some advantage, some protection from this, and they're in a situation where they are paying for their bandwidth and they're paying a premium for their bandwidth, this is just about the worst of all possible situations. This, to me, ultimately points out why a technological solution alone is never going to be enough, especially in the realm of privacy. This is why it's so important that we understand what happened with this privacy fight and we do our utmost to try to push this back onto a stronger footing. We could then couple good, reasonable, cost-effective technological solutions with regulatory backing, also explore better norms of privacy, better expectations of privacy, and just have a much more holistic solution to this human need to be able to have discreet and private conversations and activities online. As gutting as the loss of the privacy rules at the FCC were, it in some ways teaches us, it's an instructable moment for how to perhaps better navigate and marshal our strengths for a fight that's already starting to shape up over network neutrality. Sadly, as John Oliver a couple of years ago helped us understand, that network neutrality is a really boring name for something that's very, very important. It's not necessarily as understandable as privacy online, but it really should be. And it's just about fair rules of play. It's about preserving the internet as a commons that is equally available to incumbents and innovators alike, so that we continue to get to the advantages of this technological engine to drive progress forward. That Title II reclassification that I talked about at the outset, as wonky as that sounds, was much more about network neutrality, even though it has strong bearings on the privacy fight. In the case of network neutrality, what we're dealing with here are some legal battles following on from that reclassification, the most recent of which on appeal actually went in favor of the FCC's ruling of reclassing the ISPs. Ajit Pai, who's taken over as the chair of the FCC since Tom Wheeler left last year, has made it pretty abundantly clear that he is anti-network neutrality. There's a surface narrative here, again, about putting the ISPs back under the oversight of the FTC, and then it's not that they're against network neutrality when Pai or his supporters are talking about this, but it's more about an appropriate agency to oversee that. That's kind of bullshitty in the sense that the FCC is about communications, in as much as the Federal Trade Commission is about fair operating of companies and consumer protections, we're really talking much more about infrastructure here. We're talking about access to communication, and I think the FCC, in my opinion, in my experience at least, is better equipped to deal with that in as far as they've dealt with broadcast medium and telecommunications of other varieties. As Ajit Pai has set the stage for what it is that he would like to do here, and there's already a Democratic Congress critter who has called him out, stands for basically making a strong statement of action or principle without the necessary sort of procedural follow through or setup in this case. No notice of inquiry, no notice of rulemaking. Not that I think that this is going to stop those interested in shutting down things like network neutrality from proceeding with their attempts to do so. What's more concerning is that on the Hill, we've already seen a new law, a proposed law put forward that would back what it is that PI wants to do. That's the more concerning bit. There can be quibbles about the proper process at the FCC in terms of formulating rules or repealing rules already in place. Those are trumped, though, if we get a new law. The upside to this gambit on the Hill against network neutrality is it opens up the supporters of this bill to public interest. You can call your Congress critters about this issue, about this bill, and ask them to take a stand. Talk to their staffers. Register your views as a constituent. And undoubtedly, we will see mass calls for action should this bill start to move forward in the ways that its advocates want to see it move. My sense is that this bill, being a much more straight-up bit of regulation than the CRA amendment, much more will be exposed to the kinds of public pressures. I think we got very close, actually, to stopping the CRA amendment, part of why that was so gutting to lose the privacy fight at the FCC. I think we have a much stronger track record of dealing with legislation like SOPA and the laws that followed on from that in terms of looking to organizations like Electronic Frontier Foundation, Fight for the Future, and others to really motivate those interested in a fair and open internet to do what can be done at the moments when it needs doing to prevent a bill like this going forward. What I would really like to see in terms of legislation, though, is an internet title. This is an idea that actually I heard at a science fiction convention of all places. Vint Cerf was talking on a panel on the science track, and was talking about a lot of these issues. This was a few years ago, I think one of the last times that I went to Balticon. The notion is that rather than continuing to try to strain, twist, and adapt Title I and Title II and existing laws that are 20 and some years old to a technology that has evolved so rapidly in that time, has so radically transformed regulatory pressures, norms in society, markets, and the like, we should sit down and think about what it is that makes these distinctive from what's come before and try to figure out terms and frames that make sense in terms of oversight, accountability, rules of the road, fair play, openness, equality, neutrality, and the like, much more directly for the internet rather than by comparing it to these predecessor technologies where those comparisons clearly are starting to break down. Sadly, unless we can convince Vint Cerf to run for office in some way, I'm not really sure how we get an internet title enacted in this way, as much as I think that it's going to be a better basis for these kinds of discussions in the future. It seems to me that where we're at right now is much more about this sort of incrementalism to try to shore up what it is that we have instead of overhauling it and setting the bar much higher. It's odd to me because in terms of the retrograde actions of repeals, of setting things back, those often are much more aggressive. Why is it that we can't muster the will to try to be equally aggressive in a progressive agenda to put forward sort new constitutional sorts of frames like this that clearly are much more needful? I don't think that it has to be fully at the expense of the other side. I don't think that this has to be a partisan issue in putting together an internet title. Definitely, there are economic and commercial interests here that could be served, and it could be done in a way that's just much more transparent and clear, that is easier to reason about than what we have now, where you have to kind of be able to track in your mind, like I've done over the last 20 minutes, what agency traditionally does what, how they approach these sorts of questions. What it is that we could expect from them is just a regular user of the internet who wants to have some expectation of privacy, some sense of fair play in terms of choice and competition and pricing, and we're just not there. I'm going to keep thinking about this. I'm certainly going to keep advocating for it to anybody that will listen, hopefully, as I get back up to speed and build up a good head of steam here. There might be some opportunities to espouse this idea, to continue to evolve it, because I really do think that it's much more needful than the sort of nitpicky stance that we have right now. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to record a bit of audio with your smart device and send it to the same place. Until next time, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.